It's time for the Burt Cohen Show. It's getting harder and harder for the dream to go on for most Americans. The recession continues, and we seem to have an administration right now that's, well, like the Who song said, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Well, a lot of rumbling is happening amongst, well, what used to be the liberal class. And our guest today is Chris Hedges. I'm very pleased to have Chris with us today. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Sure.
Well, let me give a brief introduction. Chris Hedges seems to be everywhere these days. He's reported for more than 50 countries and has worked for the Christian Science Monitor, National Public Radio, the Dallas Morning News, the New York Times, for which he was a foreign correspondent for 15 years. He received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights in Journalism in 2002. The Los Angeles Press Club honored Hedges' original columns in Truthdig by naming the author Online Journalist of the Year in 2009 and granted him Best Online Column Award for 2010 for his Truthdig essay, One Day We'll All Be Terrorists. Chris Hedges has taught is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York and has taught at Columbia University, NYU, and Princeton. He currently teaches inmates at a correctional facility in New Jersey. He spent 7 years in the Middle East, most of them as bureau chief there for the New York Times. He left the Times after being issued a formal reprimand for denouncing the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq. He has the written 9 books, including Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of the Spectacle, I Don't Believe in Atheists, and his best-selling American Fascist, The Christian Right and the War on America. And another book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. His latest book is The Death of the Liberal Class. Chris Hedges, thanks again for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. What is the liberal class, and how has it self-destructed?
Traditionally, liberal values have been protected within a democratic society by 5 pillars of the liberal establishment: the press, labor, universities, and in particular public education, liberal religious institutions, culture, and the Democratic Party. And all of these pillars of the liberal establishment have collapsed. They no longer protect the rights of ordinary citizens. They speak in the traditional language of liberalism and yet have walked out on core liberal values. And that is catastrophic in an open society, because what you've done, in essence, is close the channels or mechanisms within formal power structures by which incremental and piecemeal change is made possible. And that's why we're seeing, leaping up around the fringes of American society, these frightening proto-fascist movements and figures, this empowerment of a lunatic fringe of the political establishment. If you look at, for instance, the poll done on incoming Tea Party members of Congress, I think it's 100%. If it's not 100%, it's close to 100%. Don't believe that global warming exists. These people provide an emotionally consistent message, one that gives vent to a legitimate rage. But their political agenda is utterly irrational. And you can see it in the Tea Party's assault against government, from which they exempt the military, as if the military, which consumes half of all discretionary spending, is not part of government. They support the tax cuts, which Obama just obliged them with.
Yes.
And yet talk about reducing the deficit and balancing the budget.
People seem to buy into it somehow.
I beg your pardon?
People seem to buy into it somehow.
Well, it's not a rational, it's not a coherent political agenda, but it's one that's quite effective in that it responds to an emotional desire and mobilizes hatred and quite effectively against very weak scapegoats like Muslims and immigrants or undocumented workers, the liberal class itself. And I think I argue in my book that the anger towards the liberal class is not, in fact, misplaced. The liberal class, traditional liberal institutions, did betray working men and women. Bill Clinton carrying out perhaps the most egregious assault with the passage of NAFTA and so-called welfare reform 2 years later, which is why they keep extending unemployment benefits, because if you go off unemployment, then you have to attempt to survive on the $143 a month you receive from welfare, courtesy of the Democratic Party.
And it seems to me that a lot of us on the left, formerly known as liberals, when President Clinton did that welfare reform, a lot of us were hoping that that was step one and that step two would be creating jobs, because how can you have welfare reform stop the help for people without giving them an alternative, such as a jobs program, such as one of our greatest liberals, FDR, in fact, did? And you've talked a bit about the emotionalism of the Tea Party, the appeal that they have, and one has to look back a bit to the 1930s. In the Western world, the United States, as well as Europe. And here in the 1930s, we were in worse depths of economic despair. And as we saw in Germany, fascism arose there directly from this economic despair and a play to nationalism and looking for scapegoats. But why?
Well, we could have gone either way in the 1930s. You had very powerful industrialists like Henry Ford, who were very sympathetic to the fascist movement.
Yes.
Fortune magazine put Mussolini on its cover in 1934, praising the Italian dictator for defanging labor unions,
right,
at the expense of the working class. And Smedley Butler, at one point, was even approached about carrying out a coup d'etat. General Smedley Butler from the Marine Corps writes about this. And we were saved. We were saved by two things. We were saved that we had powerful populist progressive forces,
yes,
although weakened with the assault against them by Woodrow Wilson and the Espionage and Sedition Act, the Palmer Raids at the end of World War I still existed. And we had a liberal class embodied by figures like Franklin Roosevelt or his vice president, Henry Wallace,
yes,
who were not tone deaf to the suffering and injustices that had been visited upon working men and women. And so there was an example of how the liberal class functions. You have pressure from populist movements,
yes,
and you have a responsiveness on the part of a liberal elite that creates the New Deal. Now all of those radical populist movements, socialists, anarchists, communists, have been destroyed. The final culmination of that being, of course, the witch hunts, the McCarthyite witch hunts, which purged institutions, not just of communists, but people considered or condemned as fellow travelers or sympathetic or pink or soft on communism, coupled with a bankruptcy of liberal institutions themselves that have cravenly served the corporate elite for corporate money. And Clinton set out to do this quite consciously. He knew that if he did corporate bidding, he would get corporate funds.
Right.
So that by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and by the time Barack Obama ran for president, the Democrats got more. But the price for this was a betrayal of the working class and even the middle class. And that has created the political dilemma that we are in, of these formal mechanisms within systems of government that once redressed these grievances, that once worked, no longer work. So that when we get a jobs bill, courtesy of the Democratic Congress, it turns out to be $15 billion in tax credits for corporations. The passage of the FISA Reform Act at the beginning of the or the end of Obama's presidential campaign essentially retroactively made legal what under our Constitution is illegal, the warrantless wiretapping and monitoring of tens of millions of American citizens. But because Verizon and AT&T and these large telecommunications companies had given this private information to the government, there were a series of cases working their way up in the lower courts, and these telecommunications companies knew they would lose. And so they pushed through the FISA Reform Act with the usual influx of millions. I think the estimate was $11 million of corporate money. And Obama voted for the FISA Reform Act. Although as a candidate, he promised us he would filibuster it. It's just example after example of corporate fraud and abuse. And what we have undergone, in essence, is a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion. And they've won and we've lost. And the liberal institutions have been collaborators in this process.
We are talking with Chris Hedges, who is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. And his newest book is called Death of the Liberal Class. And we started a minute ago talking about the 1930s. We had an angry underclass that had been drawn to the left, certainly, despite all the Palmer raids and the Anti-Sedition Acts, which I definitely want to follow up on. But we had something here that seemed to work. It was called the New Deal. It seems we had a president with some backbone then, even though he was obviously paralyzed. He had a backbone and did something that many people on the further left feel like, well, Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself.
And, well, he did.
Yeah,
he did.
He did. And why doesn't this happen now? That program...
Because it wasn't finally Roosevelt who did it. It was, you know, the sit-down strikes,
yes,
the protests,
mm-hmm,
the bonus marchers on Washington. There were a series of forces. And I think that the strength of a liberal class is not so much its moral awareness, but its ability to listen. And Roosevelt could listen. Roosevelt was open. In a way, the liberal establishment no longer is. And he responded. And so now there is no pressure. These movements have been decimated.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama and the Democratic Party are utterly tone deaf to the difficulties that are sweeping across the country and creating a kind of permanent underclass. 2.8 million people foreclosed on their homes or had their homes repossessed by banks last year, and that number is going to be equal this year. That's almost 8,000 people a day, and we don't do anything. There is no jobs program. There is no responsiveness to tens of millions of Americans who, well, 40 million of whom live in poverty, and tens of millions who now live in a category called near poverty.
And I believe it was Thomas Jefferson, perhaps I'm wrong, talked about how a republic absolutely requires a middle class. And we have seen this again and again throughout the world, where there's just a few very wealthy and a lot of people who are rather poor, very destabilizing.
But you can't sustain a democracy in an oligarchy. And that's something that even the writers of Athenian democracy like Plutarch and Thucydides understood. And that's what the corporate, unfettered corporate capitalism has done. It has created a frightening kind of neo-feudalism. where we have a rapacious and tiny oligarchic elite which serves the interests of corporations.
And it doesn't so
and the rest of us.
And it doesn't so much matter which party. And certainly the theme, if there is any, of the Tea Party anger is, hey, government, you're not working for us. You are not listening to us. And that
all of that is true, but yes. The tragedy is that the culprits are on Wall Street, not in Washington. And the handlers of the Tea Party have quite effectively deflected attention from corporate malfeasance and corporate control to the puppets, to those in Washington. And we're attacking the puppets, not the puppeteer. And so the very forces that created the mess through the Tea Party movement stand to reap the benefit.
So, I think it's obvious what you're saying is true, that people, the anger has been very, very effectively streamed to the puppets and not the puppeteer. How can that change? How it's been frustrating.
Well, it's very difficult because the systems of mass communication are controlled by corporations. We have roughly 6 corporations that control almost everything most Americans watch, see, read, or hear. That's Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Viacom, Disney, General Electric. And those who present alternative messages exist on the fringes of society. It's very, very difficult for an analysis and an attack on the corporate state to be given mainstream or national dissemination. It's why figures like Ralph Nader have become outcasts. Why Kucinich was locked out of the debates in the Democratic primaries. The debate commission is a corporate driven entity, and in Iowa, the first debates were actually sponsored by the health and pharmaceutical industry, and the last person they were going to allow to sit up there and talk about the inefficiency and abuse of for-profit healthcare and insurance companies was Kucinich.
Yeah, for sure.
And so he wasn't there, and he was locked out, literally locked out of the debate in New Hampshire.
Yes. We do have the obvious sort of exception of MSNBC. Now, perhaps that's just a way of letting off steam because it does seem to be profitable for General Electric, which owns NBC, to have this show with Rachel Maddow.
Well, but MSNBC plays to the same script that Fox plays. They just give it a kind of liberal spin. It's the same stupid gossip and garbage about Sarah Palin or who said this or who did that. It's court gossip. It's not news. It's not analysis. It's trash. It's just trash from a different angle. But if you look at the topics of conversation, they're driven by corporate media. And I don't think in the end that it is remotely helpful because there's no deep discussion or analysis of the structures that have reconfigured the democratic state and all but crushed the open society. That you're not hearing that on MSNBC.
Well, that's true, and we do seem to have a hunger for getting that back. Certainly the Tea Party has been channeled very, very effectively, and it seems like the power elite learned a great deal from previous situations in America where the people actually led the leaders, and there have been many, many examples of that.
All the correctives to American democracy didn't come from the top.
That's right.
They came from movements that held fast to moral imperatives. And these movements never achieved formal political power. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement. I mean, you could argue that the most powerful figure in American society in 1968 was Martin Luther King.
Yes.
Because when he went to Memphis or Birmingham, 50,000 people went with him.
Yes. And I think it's fairly obvious that is why he was murdered, because he was...
Well, what happened was when King stood up in Riverside Church in April of 1967.
Yes.
And denounced the Vietnam War, calling America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. The Johnson administration took away the FBI plainclothes protection that had been assigned to him. And at that point, both King and Johnson knew what that meant.
Yeah, yeah. That April 4th, 1967 speech, if people haven't read it, I urge you, Google it and check it out. And there have been, you know, certainly Obama used this notion of hope. I believe, was given an advertising industry award for having the best PR campaign using.
Well, he was the top annual award of advertising ages, and beating out Nike, Zappos, Apple to win Marketer of the Year. I mean, the experts know damn well what he did.
Yeah.
And he functioned, Obama functioned as a brand.
Yes.
In the same way that Calvin Klein or Benetton a few years earlier had used HIV-positive models and people of color to give their products a kind of risque style and sense of progressive politics. It gave their products an edge, but the object, as with all brands, was to confuse a brand with an experience, and that was the Obama campaign writ large. And what we're seeing now, and I'm not sure tragic is the right word, because Obama is complicitous in what he did. He's, unlike Bush, intelligent and understands the centers of power and what he has to do to serve them. But we're watching the corporations crumple up and throw Obama away. They don't need him anymore.
Fascinating. But there has been political power on the streets. You know, it doesn't come from the top. It's there seems to be a certain psychology throughout many cultures and many times to just want, in Spanish, a caudillo, a great leader, somebody on a white horse, Ronald Reagan, somebody like that. But history shows again and again that it has to come from the streets. And it worked in the civil rights movement. It worked in the Vietnam movement. We, those of us on the streets, ended the war and ended what had been legal segregation. And one of the things I admire most about Franklin Roosevelt was he understood this. My understanding of a conversation between him and A. Philip Randolph, who was head of the Brotherhood of Railroad Porters, something like this. I don't know if I have the exact words. I agree with you in terms of ending discrimination. I agree with you. I want to do it. Now make me do it. And he took to the streets. The railroad porters took some action. We took to the streets in Vietnam. We made the president do it. How can we, progressives who are severely disappointed and recognize, hey, we got used, how can we make Obama do it like the people made FDR do it? Or does he just not listen to the people? Does he feel like...
It's clear that the structures of power do not listen to the people. I mean, for instance, if you take the first bailout bill, $700 billion. Constituent calls were 100 to 1 against the bailout across the political spectrum. Initially, some of the most vocal opponents of the bailout were right-wing Republicans on the House floor from Texas. But it passes anyway. Why? Because the corporations want it passed. If you look at the 2006 midterm elections, the Democrats retake control of Congress around the issue of the Iraq War, highly unpopular,
yes,
and yet continue to fund the war, not only continue to fund the war, but increase troop levels in Iraq by 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
There is utter lack of responsiveness on the part of the Democratic Party in these institutions. And the only way we can make them respond is to turn on them, which means in the next election, not allowing us to frighten, to use fear tactics to get us to vote Democrat, that we have to stand fast around moral imperatives. We have to understand the utter corruption of the electoral system itself, and we have to rebuild movements. And if we don't do that, we are going to cede power to some very, very frightening figures who I blame the liberal class for creating. Figures like Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, Mike Huckabee. I mean, these are very disturbing characters. And I think that they are quite effectively articulating
yes.
the anger that has swept across the country, because we in the liberal establishment, who purportedly care about these issues, have not risen up. And at first, it's going to be a very lonely stance, and everybody's mm-hmm. going to tell you not to waste your vote or not to do this protest or that protest. But it isn't going to start unless one of us begins to step forward, and it's got to start now because time's running out, not just economically, but environmentally.
Mm. We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with author Chris Hedges, who is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute, and his newest book is called Death of the Liberal Class. Very disturbing. Now, what do you say, and I hear this all the time, what do you say to Democrats who say the progressives, the liberals, are on a radical fringe or unrealistic? Liberals make up only about 20% of the voting population. They insist we're not being realistic. We must go what they call centrist or lose what we have. And that they say that if we undermine President Obama, we may ensure the election of a real right-winger, a real kind of neo-fascist.
Well, that's the argument. I think, in fact, if you look at the polls, the national polls, in terms of how people view members of Congress, you see that the distaste for elected official runs wide and deep across the political spectrum. And I think the reason that we are seeing the rise of these kind of proto-fascist figures like Palin is directly attributable to the bankruptcy of liberalism. And if we continue to support a bankrupt liberalism, which is tone deaf to the pain visited on working men and women, then we are guaranteed that these lunatics will take power. The only hope left is to rise up around moral imperatives that the Democratic Party and the liberal class have abandoned. If we don't do that, then we are finished. And if we buy into this least worst scenario
right.
that crops up at every election, then the very values that we cherish are going to be snuffed out.
And what have we really accomplished with Obama? Yes, there have been some...
Nothing.
Well, there have been some progressive changes, but the...
Well, you'd have to list them for me. I'm not sure what they would be.
Well, it's so much easier to list the things that have been extremely disappointing from early on when it became clear that his economic...
But I don't think Obama's passed any progressive legislation. I mean, I'd want to know what it was.
Well, perhaps not. I'd have to think about that for a while.
Well, I'd be interested. I follow it pretty closely. Yeah. I haven't seen any. I mean, the health care bill was just the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the for-profit pharmaceuticals and insurance company. I mean, he has...
The one good thing about it is the children can be up to age 26 and still be on...
Well, not anymore. He's just granted exemptions because Wellfleet and Cigna and Aetna don't want to insure chronically sick children. I mean, even that got taken out.
Huh.
It's an awful bill. It's just going to, you know, further increase the anger. I mean, we're going to be forced to buy their defective product. They can continue to raise co-payments and premiums, including for people on fixed income. It's, you know, $400 billion in government subsidies to these corporations. It's awful. If you look at the analysis of the plan done by Physicians for a National Health Plan out of Harvard,
right.
It's just a huge corporate giveaway, just one more. And we have just been betrayed. And if we don't begin to fight for things like single-payer, not-for-profit health care for all Americans, just to pick one small example, then we're going to end up with, kind of totalitarian capitalism, which is going to be very scary. We're going to look a lot like China.
Mm. And it's so true that our our hope was continued. A lot of Obama supporters felt, oh, this is, you know, it's not everything we wanted. It's not single payer, but it's better than nothing. Well, maybe.
Well, that wasn't the argument. The argument at the end of the bill was, it's not a great bill, but we have to pass it because it's a referendum on the Obama presidency.
Yeah.
And if we don't pass it, Obama and the Democrats will go down. That became the final argument for the bill, because the bill itself was awful when you read it.
And his...
and so once again, we're reduced to supporting a party that betrayed our interests, with the raison d'etre being that if we don't, a more frightening political configuration will rise up and take its place. Well, the reason a frightening political configuration is rising up is because we speak in a very hypocritical language. We continue to speak in a language that purports to care about the interests of the working class, while we betray the working class. And I come out of the working class. My family is all from the mill towns in the state of Maine. They've been devastated by NAFTA, and they may not have gone to a fancy college, but they're not stupid. And they know what's being done, and they know what's happening. And I think, you know, much of my anger towards the liberal establishment is what they've done to my own family. It's personal, and it's wrong.
And it's
worth fighting back.
I believe it is worth fighting back, and that's one thing. The fact that there was, you know, even though it was used, even though it was a marketing ploy, the fact that there was this widespread hope for real change, I think that shows that there is some strength among progressives, and there may be some better direction that is possible. And people have certainly been frustrated that we really were used. I talked to somebody recently during the recent election who wasn't voting Democrat because of health care. And I said, well, we talked about it for a little while, and the basic bottom line was she didn't think it went far enough. And it's amazing to me how tail between the legs the members of Congress seem to be. I guess it's because of the funding for their campaigns, given that they have to depend, or they believe they have to depend, on the corporate interests. Somehow it reminds me of a picture I have of the old feudal system, where the peasants are happy to grovel for whatever the aristocrats throw them, and they just, you know, as long as they don't get totally destroyed, they're in thanks to being able to barely survive. And that's not what the liberal vision used to be. There has not been any coherent message. As Bob Borisar on this show a few weeks ago said, that passion attracts and the cautious positioning alienates. And we are starting to see this happening. Now, the Obama team, they have something called 2012 coming up. They have to see that the base is being alienated and angered. Is there any possible way?
But it doesn't matter.
Now, why is that?
Because if they don't get the backing of corporations, they're finished. Especially after Citizens United. They watched what happened to Russ Feingold.
Yes.
For every ad that Russ Feingold was able to put on a TV, there were five or six
anti
by unnamed groups that tore him to pieces.
Yep.
The resources available.
Well, don't people see that, though? Isn't that fairly obvious what's happening here? I mean,
they don't. I mean, Feingold would have been reelected if they did.
Yeah.
And Obama is going to make a swing to the right, not to the left. He already did it today.
Yes.
With the tax cuts. He's going to replace Lawrence Summers with some CEO from Wall Street.
Yeah.
You can get worse than Lawrence Summers, which is hard to imagine.
That is, I must say.
And appealing to Obama's better nature is like writing letters to Uncle Joe Stalin. It's useless. It isn't going to work.
Or to Santa Claus, I suppose. We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Chris Hedges, senior fellow at the Nation Institute. His new book is Death of the Liberal Class. And you talk about Russ Feingold. His name keeps popping up now and then. And we have had many situations where an incumbent president, a Democrat in particular, was challenged from the left. And there's a lot of discussion about that. Perhaps we could, let's start off with Henry Wallace, actually, who was vice president, who's not nearly well known enough, in my opinion, who was ejected by certain powers within the Democratic Party, people surrounding FDR, really controlling FDR in 44. He was dumped as vice president, and then he ran himself as a Progressive Party candidate in 1948. Now, did a progressive run by Henry Wallace hurt the Democratic Party? And continuing with that line, Ted Kennedy ran against kind of a corporate Democrat in 1980, Jimmy Carter.
So, well, let's be clear about Wallace, is that the Democratic Party and the liberal establishment tarred Wallace with being soft on communism and turned him into a political pariah.
Yes.
So that after 1948, Henry Wallace was a non-entity within the American political establishment. And Wallace is an important figure. 48 is also when we have the Taft-Hartley Act,
yeah.
A single most piece of legislation, or destructive piece of legislation,
yes,
against labor since NAFTA, until NAFTA. And that is a, you know, very important part of my book, that those kind of witch hunts that were carried out against people soft on communism not only destroyed the progressive and populist movements that kept the liberal class honest, but internally decimated liberal institutions, so people like Wallace, who was hardly a communist,
right,
but who had a conscience, were pushed out. Wallace was probably the last figure, with maybe the exception of McGovern, who stood up to the military-industrial complex, which has consumed 50% of all discretionary spending since the end of World War II. And we have Obama carrying out this very cynical maneuver of freezing federal wages, as if wages to
working
federal
people,
employees, have
right,
anything to do with a massive deficit. And yet, of course, the ideology of the corporate state is to constantly attack workers.
Right.
So that we see in New Jersey this assault against teachers' unions. The last readout of unionized activity is in the public sector, and they're determined to destroy it. And Obama's complicitous with this. And we never mention the incredible sums we waste on armaments and Virginia-class submarines. And I mean, it's an endless list.
Yeah, it's amazing how the deficit peacocks go around talking about deficit, but they will not even mention military welfare, which is corporate welfare to a certain group of military contractors. And it hasn't, as far as I can tell, increased our actual security. It does seem we were somewhat vulnerable on September 11th, 2001, that all our defense trillions didn't seem to matter particularly.
But it's even worse. I mean, we have a situation in Iraq or Afghanistan where we're losing the war.
Yes, clearly.
Where the concerns of the nation or the infeasibility of the occupation itself are irrelevant, because there are huge corporations for whom this war means tremendous amounts of profit.
Right.
And they will keep it going as long as they make money. Raytheon, Halliburton, Northrop Grumman, Blackwater, now renamed Z, all of these corporations, war's a good business.
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't really matter whether it is in the interest of the nation or the number of human lives it consumes. And we watch because government is part of the problem. We've ripped down our trade barriers, which has allowed these corporations like Halliburton, which is parasitic, it makes all of its money from taxpayers, to set up subsidiaries in Dubai where it doesn't have to pay income tax. I mean, this is the kind of system we're creating.
Yes. We are talking, again, on the Burt Cohen Show with Chris Hedges, senior fellow at the Nation Institute, largely about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. We've had presidential primaries. Ted Kennedy ran a bit to the left, certainly, of Carter. But can you blame Ted Kennedy for Reagan's win. I don't believe we can. So what happens if a Feingold, for example, whose name is being talked about quite a bit now, as if he ran for president, would that destroy, would it be fair if Obama loses, if he's the nominee, would it be fair to blame a primary race for Obama's loss, or is it the blame lie elsewhere?
Well, my argument is we better stop focusing on electoral politics or we're all going to sound like MSNBC. The problem is the system's rigged. And the Democrats will run on issues, as Obama did, as Kerry did. All of the anti-war organizations, which had built a real momentum. I mean, huge demonstrations, 100,000 people in New York, San Francisco.
Yeah, big.
They called a moratorium because they had to elect Kerry. And then Kerry got up at the convention saluting like a little soldier boy and talking about victory in Iraq and how he wouldn't have withdrawn from Fallujah. In essence, he wiped his feet all over us, and we stood by and did nothing. We've got to stop placing our faith in a system that doesn't work.
Yeah.
If we don't take what little power we have now and use it in terms of building movements and protesting, then this assault will extinguish our open society. And sitting around wondering whether somebody's going to run or isn't going to run, I think misses the issue.
The point is to, you know, I don't know whatever happened to that famous photograph of that guy in Beijing standing up one person to the tanks, but that's a very inspirational figure. People lose a lot in those situations. I mean, you have said that compared to activism of the past, Americans appear to be remarkably cowed and complacent, I would say. But you say an explosion, unless we halt the increased pressure, seems inevitable. What might that look like? I mean, the other side has all the guns and the training, and if I don't want to see it come to bloodshed in the streets, and I'm not sure if it seems like a very anarchic anger right now without any kind of a focus.
Well, it's relatively stable because our currency is relatively stable, but we're playing a very dangerous game as we monetize our debt, which is a fancy way of saying we are now printing $600 billion worth of money without anything to back it up.
Yeah, that's some scary stuff.
They want to create inflation because it helps reduce the deficit. But can you control inflation? I think economists debate whether or not this plan will work. It's never been tried before. But there is no debate among economists that if it doesn't work, the consequences could be catastrophic, including hyperinflation.
Yeah.
And the system subsists by borrowing about $2 billion a day from the Chinese. We now have $12.8 trillion in debt, which by the time we have to maintain it will mean borrowing $96 billion a week.
Mm.
It's not a sustainable system over the long run. You don't need economics 101 to figure it out. If China and the oil-rich states don't continue to buy that debt, then the buyer of last resort becomes the Federal Reserve, which means they just continually crank out money.
And
at that point, the currency becomes junk.
Yes.
That's what we're playing with. Now, if we enter a period of deep instability, which would be caused by, I think, probably a currency collapse, then I think there are very frightening forces and movements within the United States.
Yes.
Who would employ violence. I mean, I don't take it lightly when I see members of Tea Party rallies show up with weapons.
Right.
I think there is a very dark undercurrent of violence in American society.
Yes.
And I fear that the failure on the part of the liberal class to stand up for the kind of civic values and virtues that are instrumental in maintaining an open society will have catastrophic consequences. And that's why I think all of us have to begin to stand up now, which is why on December 16th, I'm going to this to an anti-war rally, or it's the largest anti-war rally organized by veterans against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in Washington, in Lafayette Park, and then Daniel Ellsberg and Medea Benjamin from Code mm-hmm. Pink and Dr. Margaret Flowers from Physicians for a National Health Plan and Ray McGovern, former CIA operative, and yes. several veterans will all attempt to chain ourselves to the fence of the White House. I mean, I think I'm not, you know, I don't live in self-delusion, but at the same time, not to carry out these kinds of acts, not to physically protest, I think, is to extinguish all hope, to remain home and be passive, as to become complicit in state crime.
Yes, it's interesting the power that things like that have. You have to, I think, certainly recognize that images form opinion these days. It's not so much, you know, reading newspapers about the positions and policies and the nuances thereof. It's the images. And, the old expression, one picture says 1,000 words. Well, capturing the imagination, I think, is absolutely essential. And I recall at one anti-war protest about around 1970, Nixon was in the White House, and there was a ring of buses, bumper to bumper, literally touching one another around the White House. And I understand inside those buses were troops amassed, ready to protect the president. Now, there was never a threat from the people, the citizens, but the fact that President Nixon perceived that there was all this power out there, there is power among the people. There can be. I know that seems sort of, it can sound kind of naive to suggest that, but there has been that. And if people could stand up, then we could have tremendous power. And certainly history has shown, I think, that nonviolent civil disobedience can be extremely effective. The most effective weapon of the people that I'm familiar with is a general strike. The only problem with that is it doesn't do anything unless you get a lot of people to do it.
Well, the other problem is if you don't have a manufacturing sector, it's very hard to strike.
True.
Most people in the working class work in the service sector.
Yes.
Which is, they're non-unionized.
Right.
They're in places like Walmart, where the average Walmart worker works 28 hours a week.
With no health care.
Puts them below the poverty line and qualifies them for food stamps.
Hmm.
Walmart dismisses its workers at staggered intervals so that there's no kind of connection. They have strike-busting teams that they fly all around the country. It's difficult.
Well, what?
It's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
In the reconfiguration of our working class, where people are barely hanging on by their fingertips.
Well, there's never been a real sense of working class solidarity in this country, as you pointed out, ever since, you know, the First World War, the anti-sedition and the other acts. There hasn't been any sense of class consciousness in this country, which I think is...
Oh, I think there was. I think it on the eve of World War I there was.
Oh, right. But since then...
Which is why this mass propaganda machine under the Committee of Public Information or the Creel Commission was
yes.
put in place.
Yes.
To destroy that class consciousness, and to destroy those movements that remained fiercely anti-war. And remember, we went into World War I because the bankers had lent tremendous sums to the British and the French.
Yep, that's the only reason.
And if we lost the war, they wouldn't be paid back. There was no popular support for the war at all. Most people didn't want anything to do with it.
Of course.
Wilson had run for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war."
Right.
And so they had to build up the first system of mass propaganda.
Right.
In modern society, which not only used film divisions and news divisions and speakers' bureaus to spread this propaganda, but quite effectively studied the insights into mass psychology by Le Bon and Trotter and Sigmund Freud. And they knew that people were moved by emotion,
yes,
not by reason, not by fact.
Right.
And all of these people migrated once the war was over to Madison Avenue and started working for corporations. And we've never recovered from that. So the class consciousness, the language of class warfare, which was very much a part of these movements
sure.
in the early 1900s,
yeah.
was eradicated.
So,
and we've lacked the very words by which we can describe what's happening to us.
And that's a remarkable success for the the corporate oligarchy that clearly is in control of us. Again, we're talking with Chris Hedges of the Nation Institute, whose new book is The Death of the Liberal Class. What can people do? How can people be effective? And one of the further chilling effects was there were raids on the homes of organizers and protesters at the Republican convention, so that any Americans who dare dissent against the so-called war on terrorism, which is, of course, undermine the profits of the military contractors, all under the guise of fighting the terrorist threat. It's clearly intentionally chilling. How do we deal with this, what you call, and if you're against the war on terrorism, obviously you are a terrorist sympathizer. We've heard such things before. If you're against the war on communism, as was Henry Wallace, he didn't think it would be productive at all, then you must be a communist sympathizer. What? I mean, they're so effective at chilling dissent. What tools do we, the people, have at our discretion now that can perhaps save this country from going to real dangerous extremes?
Well, I think it really comes down to our bodies, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing on the 16th. I think it's really in the street now. That's all we have left.
All right, but there's very, very few of us. Liberals, as I said earlier, only make up a small portion of the population.
Right, but I don't like the category. Most of my relatives in Maine, I suppose, are all considered rednecks, and they're all vets, and they have gun racks. And I don't consider myself a liberal anymore. I think we have to speak to people not in the language of ideology, but in the very real issues of a living wage, of health care for all Americans, of Social Security. No matter what someone's political stripe is in a Walmart, are they going to be against health care and a pension and a living wage?
Well, I think part of the problem is that the middle class has been taken by the other side, and I think you're absolutely right. The middle class is, the former middle class is really angry, justifiably so. I wonder, in this election, in the 2010 election, it seemed that they were convinced that the Tea Party, the Republican Party, was more on their side. How can we? I think you're absolutely right. Connecting with
well,
these
but
people,
I think
where
that
they
we
are.
Have to. We have, those of us who care about traditional liberal values, have to adopt or accept that the rage that is being expressed by the Tea Party, not only towards government, but to the liberal establishment, is a legitimate rage.
Yes.
And we have to adopt that rage as our own and express it. Otherwise, we're finished. And that means turning on traditional liberal institutions, including the Democratic Party and including Barack Obama. And if we don't do that, then, as Yeats said, we will enter an age where the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity.
Hmm.
I watched Yugoslavia break down. I covered it for the New York Times. The similarity is terrifying. It was the economic collapse of Yugoslavia that vomited up these buffoonish figures like Radovan Karadzic or Slobodan Milosevic or Franjo Tuđman.
Mm-hmm.
And you laugh at these people in the way that the intelligentsia in Berlin used to laugh at the Nazis, the way we laugh at Sarah Palin. But you pay for it in the end. And that's one of my complaints with Colbert and Jon Stewart. They function the way the cabarets function in Berlin, where we let off our steam by lampooning these buffoonish figures and making them figures of ridicule without understanding how deadly the situation has become.
And that sanity rally by those two, I think effectively, I don't know if it was intentional, but effectively dissipated the anger that people spent that energy getting down there, being there, and then poof.
Well, it was a form of entertainment.
Entertainment,
all of the
yes, entertainment.
Political content of a Boy Scout jamboree. if that's who we are, then there's no hope.
Well, perhaps there is. I'd love to talk more about this. We could spend another hour. We've come up toward the end. The book is by Chris Hedges, death of the liberal class. I wonder if there's a, well, I just wonder, quick question. I don't know if they can be answered quickly. Can the Democratic Party be taken over by Democrats? Or is
no.
it too late? No.
It's already been taken over by corporations.
Right. As I expected. Well, thank you, Chris Hedges, for being with us. What's the best way to look at your work on the Internet? I'm sure there must be...
I have a column every Monday for Bob Scheer's website out of L.A., TruthDig.
Uh-huh. And so the just go to TruthDig, I suppose. That would probably be it. Thank you very much. And hopefully people can get up and stand up and do something about our future and our values and not give up on it quite yet. Thanks very much for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show.
Thank you.
All right. Email me, Burt, at theburtcohenshow.com.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold.
Sky. Take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours on earth. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Jump, jump.
Stand up for your rights.
Traveling on,
don't give up the fight.
Yeah,
we're sick and tired of your isms, kids.